by the health division in the state, yes.
Right. But if that same person who would qualify as a volunteer were contracted to provide this service on an emergency basis, then they would not be covered. Is that correct?
If the individual were employed to provide health care services, say, by a health care facility that is in, you know, private mm-hmm. practice, they would not be covered. They have to not be paid to have the protection of the State Tort Claims Act in order to have coverage under this proposal. Okay. It was looked into for all health care providers. The Attorney General and others were very concerned about the fiscal impact this would have on this particular legislation. And while, again, philosophically, at least the Medical Association would have ideally had all health care workers covered under the State Tort Claims Act under these circumstances, it's just not politically doable under the current circumstances.
Thank you.
So the facility, if it were an emergency facility, a private, and they were a classified emergency facility, the facility itself would be covered, but not its hired employees?
Its hired employees would not be, but volunteers who would be on a registry with the division who would participate would be covered by this act.
Senator Morissette. Yes,
thank you. I see where you cover out-of-state volunteers under two circumstances, but if something happened in Portland and people came over to Vancouver, Washington to help because there was an emergency, they were volunteers from another state, they would not be covered, or would they?
Senator Fisher, Senator Morissette, under the Interstate Compact Act, which was adopted by the legislature, the governor has the authority under the emergency powers of his office where he or she said that we were in a state of emergency, could, in fact, have healthcare workers or others from out of state come into the state, and they would be protected under the State Tort Claims Act.
Okay. I think we have someone else that wishes to expand a little on what we're talking about. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Keith Cutler with the Department of Justice. I agree with all of the answers you've heard so far. I'm just hoping to clarify a little bit. With respect, Mr. Chair, to your question about coverage of facilities, it's going to depend on whether the facilities are acting in the normal course of their business or if they've been made part of an emergency operation. If they're just doing stuff in the normal course of their business, if a disaster happens in Multnomah County, for example, and under the standard plans that are in place, they start handling the emergencies, they're in the normal course of their business and likely would not be covered by this act. But if the Multnomah County Public Health Officer or the state public health officer were to set up, say, a triage center in a parking lot of a Walmart, to give just one example, that kind of an emergency center would be covered by this. The second question, of course, has to do not just with the centers, but with the healthcare workers who are involved, and that gets to most of the other questions that have been asked. If the healthcare workers are coming from within the state of Oregon, then there's a couple of questions we want to know. Where are they coming from? If they're part of this registry that's set up under this act, then those healthcare workers will be acting under this act if they do so on a volunteer basis. Again, if they're acting in the normal course of their business, say an emergency doctor in an emergency room in the hospital that he or she is always practicing in, then that's not covered here. But all the volunteers pursuant to the registry who are asked or directed to go someplace in order to deal with an emergency would be covered here. In addition, this provides an opportunity for volunteers who are not on a registry to appear at a healthcare facility for purposes of lending their services in this kind of an emergency. And they also would be covered if they are allowed to work in that environment pursuant to the credentialing and operations emergency operations plan that the facility has in place. If I may just address Senator Morissette's question about the folks coming from other states. And this gets to what Mr. Gallant was saying with respect to the Emergency Management Assistance Compact that the legislature enacted in the first special session last year. If they come pursuant to a request, first of all, the governor has to make an appropriate declaration to start EMAC going. And then if under EMAC, Oregon makes a request of another state and another state sends its personnel pursuant to that arrangement, and they would be covered under the provisions of that compact. And by its provisions, that compact makes those personnel from another state coming here agents of the state subject to our Tort Claims Act.
May I?
Yes, Senator Morrison.
Thank you. But, okay, a volunteer, if somebody shows up at the Walmart parking lot because there's a huge explosion and they happen to be from another state and they want to help, they would not be covered.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morrison, they would be covered if the emergency facility allowed them to operate pursuant to the credentialing and emergency operations plan that facility has. So, for example, what's contemplated is that the Department of Human Services will develop these plans to the extent that existing facilities have their own credentialing and operations plans. But if a public health entity sets up a emergency operations center, emergency health facility, for purposes of dealing with this kind of an emergency, they will do so pursuant to rules that require them to have a particular kind of credentialing and operations plan in effect. So when the doctors, for example, show up and say, we'd like to help, as long as they're credentialed under that, those doctors would be covered. The example we used in our conversations when we were working all of this out was, suppose the AMA has a convention in Portland, and there's doctors from all over the country there. Something happens. They clearly wouldn't be on our registry here because they're not regularly here in Oregon. Would they be able to practice? And it's exactly under this scenario that they could appear and be permitted to practice.
Thank you very much. I will close public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2410.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Morissette,
with House Bill 2410 as amended.
Oh.
It has not been amended?
No. It's already been amended.
It's been amended. Oh, on the House side. Okay. Move House Bill 2410A to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morissette has moved that we send House Bill 2410 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burnett? Senator Farnum?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries. Do we have a carrier?
I'd be happy.
Senator Morissette will be the carrier. Close the work session on House Bill 2410 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3157.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3157 authorizes dental hygienists and dental assistants to perform oral health screenings under written training and screening protocols adopted by the Board of Dentistry. We have the -A6 amendment, which resolves conflicts with House Bill 2240 and is related to definitions in the bill.
And Paul Cosgrove.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association. HB 3157 does two things. The first is it permits dental hygienists and, as amended by the House, also dental assistants to perform oral health screenings under protocols adopted by the Board of Dentistry and to communicate the results of those findings to the parents or guardians or persons being screened. That provision is Section 5 of the bill. The second thing it does is it addresses and eliminates some duplicative initial education requirements for the limited access permit dental hygienists, updates the required course list, permits initial limited access permit education requirements to be taken through any accredited health professional school that the board approves, which provides some more opportunities for people living in rural areas who are not nearby a dental hygiene accredited school but might be nearby a nursing school. And it permits classes to be taken through distance learning and other similar methods. The conflict amendment that staff just mentioned deletes Section 1 of the bill because, as it appears before you, Section 1 of the bill is identical to Section 1 of House Bill 2240, which was a Board of Dentistry bill adopted unanimously by this committee several weeks ago. So it's a conflict amendment to just remove the duplicative section. I would be happy to answer any questions. I just might point out the Board of Dentistry supports the bill. I think once the amendments were made in the House, the bill, it's correct to say the bill has no opposition, and it came to you off the consent calendar on the House floor. So we'd urge your adoption of the conflict amendments and passage of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Paul. So we need to adopt the -A6 amendments. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Anyone else wish to testify on House Bill 3157? Let's see, no one. I would entertain a motion to,
Mr. Chair,
accept the A6 amendments.
I move the -A6 amendments to House Bill 3157.
Senator Starr moves that we adopt the A6 amendments to House Bill 3157. Is there any discussion or objection? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morrison?
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. Senator Carno is excused.
Mr. Chair,
motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3157, as amended, the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves House Bill 3157, as amended, with the A6 amendment to the Senate floor. With a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Seeing none, will the clerk call a roll?
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator
Morrison?
Aye.
Senator
Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries. You wish to carry it, Senator Starr? Senator Starr will carry the bill. Close the work session on House Bill 3157 and open the work session on House Bill 2410 so that Senator Burdick can have a vote without objection. Senator Burdick, how do you vote?
Hi, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for doing that for me.
I apologize. I didn't notice that you were there. I would have at least put you excused on the record.
I appreciate the chance to vote. This is a very good bill. Thank you.
Senator Burdick votes aye on House Bill 2410. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2410 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3156.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3156 directs the Department of Human Services to establish a foodborne illness prevention program. And let's see, you do have a fiscal impact statement in your packet and also the vote sheet in the House floor.
Yeah. I would call Gail Shibley and Bill Perry. Representative Repine, I think you know that we don't allow that kind of a demonstration.
Thank you, Chair.
I owed you that one from 1993.
Thank you, Chair Fisher, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Perry. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Restaurant Association, and we introduced House Bill 3156. The problem that we were trying to address is, if you're, I'm assuming you're aware that the food inspection program in Oregon is adopted rule by the state, and then counties are allowed to have delegation authority to do the food program in their counties. One of the issues that our multi-unit operators have had was the interpretation by some of the counties was very inconsistent, and getting corrections made to counties that were inconsistent was becoming more and more difficult. So when we introduced the bill was to take away delegation authority. The Department of Human Services actually pulled together the local county health officials and the industry, and we had work groups which came up with 3156 in the compromised form. And what this will allow is it still allows the counties to do the local health inspections, but what it does is it has everybody come to have some input on how it's been working on an annual basis through an intergovernmental agreement. So if there are any inconsistencies, we all basically get a voice at that time to try to correct some of the problems. The agreement is still between the counties and the state to do the food program, but we think that this will be a good way for everybody to correct any problems as they come up in the future. So as far as I know, everybody's been in agreement or not opposed to the bill in its current form, and it came unanimous on the House floor. So with that, I would pass the mic or take questions, whichever you prefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gail Shibley, Administrator of the Office of Public Health Systems and Department of Human Services. And as Mr. Perry stated, this is, in fact, a good bill passed unanimously off the House floor. Good people, good process, good faith effort to end it up with a good product, and it's a good bill, should pass. We think that it adds some real strength, some vitality, and some consistency with strong state oversight delivered locally as part of an integrated system at the local level, but with real accountability by all parties and from all parties. We believe that taking doing away with delegation and putting it into annual intergovernmental agreements allows and requires everybody to really look at what you do, how you do it, how well you're doing it, and specify roles, responsibilities, performance measures, and what happens if something is not done according to the standards and expectations that are itemized in that annual agreement. We think that the consistency in license fees is also an important issue. There is a piece in this bill that deals with, I think it's section 14 of the bill, that says that counties can determine what they need according to a formula that's specified in general in statute and will be clarified even more in rule and referred to in the IGA, the Intergovernmental Agreement, and counties can set their fees either 20% above or 20% below, and if they are outside that range, then the state shall take a look at and see what it is that's driving those costs. Why do they have to be where they say they have to be? And if they are out of line, so to speak, this bill gives the state, again, both the right and the responsibility to pull those fees back to allow for additional consistency and uniformity statewide. This is a state program. We value the partnerships that we have with the counties, and the industry is a very, very key partner with us. And we believe that this bill, as amended, provides us the opportunity to really move forward in a positive way. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions? None. I will close public hearing on House Bill 3156 and open a work session on House Bill 3156.
Mr. Chair, I would move that House Bill 3156 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morissette moves House Bill 3156 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. The motion carries, and Senator Carno is excused.
I'd like to carry the bill.
Senator Morissette wishes
to carry. Never had an opportunity to carry a bill for the Restaurant Association, let alone vote for one. So I see.
More opportunity.
So this will be an opportunity to not only carry it, but vote for it.
Mr. Chairman, it's really a fun experience to carry a bill for the Restaurant Association.
Are you going to get a return of your last tip at the restaurant that you last attended for carrying the bill?
No, this is the first.
Okay. As I said, the bill passes, motion passes, and Senator Morissette will be the carrier of the work session on House Bill 3156, and see, we're still needing a little time on 3122. Go ahead. Okay. We will go ahead then with a public hearing on House Bill 3122.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3122 allows an increase in the number of residents in certain licensed residential care facilities, and it extends the moratorium on licensing of residential care facilities until June 30th of 2005.
I can't imagine.
Okay, we have Brett Salmon for Jim Carlson, and we have Cindy Hannum and Bob Repine. I'll let you guys go ahead and however order you wish.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brett Salmon with the Oregon Healthcare Association, here for Jim Carlson, as you said. What the bill does is extends currently existing law that we have that where we have an assisted living facility and residential care facility moratorium. And kind of the reason that it was originally instituted was to deal with kind of an excess capacity that's on the market there and to kind of stabilize that assisted living facility market. And what the bill does, rather than go through the testimony totally, it extends the moratorium another 2 years and also adds a small provision that would allow for small changes in capacity where needed in a sort of underserved areas. Urge your support.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, members of excuse me, members of the committee. My name is Cindy Hannum, and I am here representing the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care, Seniors and People with Disabilities. And we also support the bill. We all agreed to it, worked on it, and we think it is a very good addition for this next biennium to go ahead and continue the moratorium with these amendments.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. Along with the other witnesses, I would support the passage of 3122A engrossed. In this last 2 years since the moratorium has been in effect, you have seen a significant slowdown in this industry. My agency, or the state agency, has only actually processed two other facilities in the last 2 years. One is still under construction, and the other one is having a difficult time ramping up. So the marketplace is still a little volatile at this point in time, and we don't see anything at this point in time changing that would justify lifting this at this moment.
All right. Anyone else wish to testify on House Bill 3122? Seeing none, it looks like we have a complete understanding here in the committee, so thank you very much for your testimony and your work ahead of time. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3122 and open work session on House Bill 3122.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would move Brown. House Bill 3122A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Brown, before I accept the motion, I think it would be most proper for me to enter a possible conflict of interest, considering the fact that I do have some ownership in some assisted living facility. And my family does, my wife included. So with that, Senator Brown moves that we accept House Bill 21, 3122 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Morissette?
Aye.
And Chair Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Clarno is excused.
And the carrier?
Yeah, we need a carrier.
I'll carry it. I'm happy to do that.
Do you defer to the caucus leader?
If he wants to carry it, he can carry it.
All right, we'll have...
I'm not going to fight him over it.
We'll have Senator...
I've already deferred.
Oh. Okay, well, Senator Brown.
Come on. I'd like to carry it, actually.
Which one of you is running competition to Senator Walker?
None of us.
Okay, the motion carries, and Senator Brown will be the carrier. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3122 and the work session on House Bill 3122 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3508.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3508 directs the Oregon Board of Dentistry to adopt rules regulating qualifications, training, education, and supervision of people who operate x-ray machines within the practice of dentistry and discontinues the regulation of x-ray machine operators within the practice of dentistry by the Department of Human Services.
No.
I have called Representative Gordon Anderson's office. I understand that he does want to testify on the bill. He'll be here soon.
It's fine. I'd ask Jane Myers and Barry?
Burl
Fletcher. Go right ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Jane Myers representing the Oregon Dental Association, and with me today is Burl Fletcher, who also works for the Oregon Dental Association, and she's our Director of Professional Affairs and has been most involved in ongoing negotiations with the Health Division, now the Health Service, and the Board of Dentistry about certification of dental assistants to expose radiographs, also known to most people as x-rays. The bill, you have some written testimony, which I'm just going to give you some of the highlights of the bill, so try to make sure everyone's comfortable with what's proposed here. What the bill does is it removes the rulemaking authority. It moves it, actually, from the Health Service to the Board of Dentistry to set the minimum standards for operator training on dental x-ray equipment. It does not eliminate training requirements for safety. It just moves them from one state agency to another one. And in many states, our surveys show that the Dental Examiners Board or the Board of Dentistry, as they may be called, are typically the boards that deal with the certification to for x-rays for dental assistants. We've had negotiations with the Health Division for about a decade on this problem. As we see it, it's a problem because it creates a barrier for getting dental assistants into the workforce. In order for them to be valuable employees in the dental office, they need to be able to expose the radiographs, what you typically think of as bite wings, dental x-rays. It reduces the amount of time the patient's appointment takes, and it's a real valuable service to the dental office. The Board of Dentistry originally requested legislation to do exactly what this bill does, but because of the Department of Administrative Services protocols about agencies introducing legislation that conflicts with other agencies, they were not able to do it. So the Oregon Dental Association requested the bill, and we do recognize it puts us kind of in a unique position of asking the legislature to change something between two state agencies that basically affects employees of our members. And I guess before we go any further, I see Representative Anderson here, and I would like to defer to his time to
thank you, Jane.
Say a few words.
Welcome, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, go ahead and have your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
For the record, Gordon Anderson from District 3. I'm here to lend testimony in support of House Bill 3508 and X-ray operator training. I sponsored the bill to address the problem getting a dental assistant certified to take dental radiographs. The Oregon Dental Association identified it as an ongoing problem they've been trying to resolve for a number of years with the Oregon Health Service. They're trying to make it easier to get dental assistants into the workforce. We're all aware of the great deal of legislative attention focused on workforce shortages and how to meet those health care needs for all Oregonians. Dr. Janet Peterson, Corvallis General Dentist, took time away from her practice to serve on both the Oregon Dental Association's task force to study workforce issues and the legislators' interim task force on health care personnel. Dr. Peterson identified the radiology certification bottleneck as a significant problem for dental assistants in gaining employment. This results in from a requirement of the Oregon Health Division that students must take 40 hours of radiation use and safety and a minimum of 10 hours of dental radiology. This before taking their test for radiology certification. Most other states do not specify the number of hours of instruction required. Many states require passage of the Dental Assistance National Board, or DANB, exam as the only requirement for certification. The Oregon Board of Dentistry also requires the DANB exam. I would hope that your passage of 3508 would simplify the process, allow flexibility, and bring more young women and men into the field of dentistry as assistants. Thank you.
Go ahead. I believe your testimony was interrupted.
There are some requirements on for the dental assistants to take X-ray. Well, on page 2, we laid out the requirements for dentists, hygienists, and assistants. The dentists and hygienists are primarily trained within their training programs in dental schools and dental hygiene schools and programs. And when they're licensed, their ability to expose radiographs follows with their license. The assistants go through this certification process, which is through the Board of Dentistry and the Health Service. Note that also the Board of Dentistry handles expanded function certifications, which are certificates that dental assistants get when they have had extra training in procedures like assisting at oral surgery or orthodontic procedures. So you have applicants, dental assistants, sometimes they're applying to the Board of Dentistry for expanded function certification and for the certificate to take X-rays. Applicants from other states must also get a case-by-case ruling from the Health Service that their safety training in the other state is substantially the same as the Oregon standard, which, by the way, the Health Service recently in May this month, I understand it's just been published, has reduced the safety training hours from 40 to 30. So I did want to make that clear. But the Board of Dentistry requires an additional 10 hours, so we're still at 40 hours. The initial certification for the dental assistant, this is a dental assistant who has not been certified in any other state, is that they apply to the board, which directs them, because the board has adopted the Dental Assistants National Board exam, to DANB, to that exam, and I've given you the phone number of the person to contact there, and the applicant pays $110 for the clinical part of the exam, $120 for the radiation health and safety, and $30 for a certification fee. If you're from another state as a dental assistant, you have to have you have to have a certification in that state to take X-rays. The state board must have required a written and clinical exam. And you have to have 1,000 hours of practice in the last 2 years in the other state. And the standards have to be similar, the safety standards, to Oregon standards. So
Can I just ask a question here before we get too far afield?
Sure.
There's $110 for the clinical part and $120 for the radiation.
That's what I understand from, I got this from the Board of Dentistry, and that's how I understood it.
Those are the exam fees.
Yeah, do you know how many hours are required in clinical as compared to the 40, which is, I take it, been lowered to 30 hours of radiation?
The Board of Dentistry requires 10 hours of clinical training, and the health services requires 30 hours. This was a recent rule change for the actual radiation and safety exam, written exam. That answer your question?
But they have to take 30 hours of training and instruction prior to writing that exam.
Right.
And only 10 hours of clinical?
Right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Brown.
A couple of questions. I've gotten some email from dentists who are actually concerned. Under the bill, I'm assuming assistants would be allowed, essentially get their licensing or their approval through the Board of Dentistry. I'm assuming everyone else, veterinarians, dentists, doctors, would still continue to have to get approval through the department. Is that right?
That's correct. This would just be for dental assistants through the Board of Dentistry, which is what had previous years it had been going through the Board of Dentistry, but through some reclarification of the law, the board's attorney determined that potentially all this time the board had not had authority to make those rules, so then it reverted back under the health division. So it's not like it hasn't been under the board in the past.
Mr. Chair, if I may. I think my concern is that if I go to a podiatrist, I know that and I get an x-ray there, that podiatrist has been through DHS and has that certification. If I'm getting an x-ray of my mouth, which I absolutely hate, I love to go to the dentist, but I hate the x-rays, I mean, that's a pretty critical area in terms of my body. I mean, I could certainly function without my feet or something wrong with my feet. If something happens in my brain or whatever, I mean, you know, I'm just a little concerned here in terms of the location and the fact that we would allow veterinarians to get their certification under DHS, but not those who are doing x-rays for the dental part. So,
Mr. Chair, if I can try to respond to the way I hear the question being raised. The health services rules are about, they're the standards. The actual training is generally going on in a school or some kind of program. And dental x-rays are, as my understanding of it, are considered, because you're working in with machinery that typically only is going to x-ray parts of the mouth, that it's so specific to dentistry that generally dentists and their dental boards are the ones who have regulated it as far as what the training should be. You're not looking at the whole human body. They're not teaching them to x-ray chests, wrists, spines, and everything else. And as that applies to veterinarians, I think they too are, they're x-raying a whole animal compared to, you know, a site-specific part of the...
Mr. Chair,
could I just ask one favor? Sure. Burl, I'm not sure that you identified yourself. Could you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, my name is Burl Fletcher, and I'm the Director of Professional Affairs for the Oregon Dental Association.
Thank you, and I apologize for not catching that sooner. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown. I think two things would maybe ease your mind. Number one, the dental machines are focused to a very tiny area, so you're not giving radiation to great expansive areas of the body as a chest x-ray or feet. Secondly, the amount of x-radiation is very, very minimal compared to a chest film, so there's really some built-in standards of safety for a dental x-ray. And I think the 40 hours, which are now 30, are focused on radiation and the dangers of radiation. the 10 hours of practice, they know how to operate the machine. Now the assistants are basically focusing on how to get clear focus, how do those teeth show up in the most ideal fashion for diagnosis. So,
yes, Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Representative Dr. Anderson. My experience on Friday afternoon of last week was I went to my dentist because I had a filling dropout, and so he took an x-ray, a little wing.
Right, tight wing.
Type x-ray. And as I sat there waiting for him to come back, after the assistant put it in a glass case, I turned the light on and looked at it, and I didn't see anything there that reflected why I came for assistance. And so he came and looked at it, and he turned to the x-ray technician and said, "I told you to do tooth number 5. She did number 4. Now, since then, I have a piece that I'm sure we'll hear from the Department of Human Services that says radiation exposure from dental x-rays is a significant health issue. A single wing bite x-ray exposes a patient to more radiation than a chest x-ray, at least 13 and up to 35 times more. And so you multiply that by the number of wing x-rays in a typical visit. Now, I had 2 at one time, and there is a public need for proper radiation safety training and so on. So, I mean, that it's interesting that I had that experience because it, right. Yeah.
Well, there's no excuse for taking the wrong tooth. Maybe I'll let... Jane, were you familiar with the comparison here? It is my understanding, and I'd have to check much more fully, but the x-ray is such a tiny area and a lesser amount.
Well, since then, my tooth has fallen out. So
oh, boy.
Step into the hallway.
Did you want to...
Chair?
Yes, Senator Brown.
While we have the good doctor here, I'm just curious where you are on the issue of fluoride.
Oh. Well, as you know, Senator, we are very much into prevention.
Okay, thank you. Well,
save the state money.
May I add to that? Do you agree that since we've been using fluoride that people have the life expectancy has doubled since we've been using fluoride?
No, but teeth do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, boy.
I want to go back and clarify something.
Oh, okay.
On this, again, for the clinical, that's 10 hours of clinical practice of x-ray?
On dental, as I understand it, that's the Board of Dentistry's requirement for operating dental equipment.
Yeah, what I wanted to know is how many hours clinically overall is required, not just in the x-ray.
Earl, he knows from school. What do they do in the school?
This much radiation.
Senator Pfister, committee. It's my understanding in the schools is as they take these training classes, they're actually working with instructors and or dentists in their offices, so they're getting the training, the clinical practice training. There has been discussions amongst the dentists that perhaps we need to up the clinical practice hours in that regard, and so we've had some discussions in there, but they do actually get clinical practice more than that. It's just that that's the minimum requirement that the board added to the health services didactic or classroom training.
Now, what is the length of time? I mean, I want to be a dental assistant, so how long is it going to take me before I can apply for a job?
Most to be a certified dental assistant in like the program that we're promoting, or even through distance learning, would take around 9 or 10 months for them to go through the training program. Many times it takes longer. Everybody learns differently. Not everybody can do the book work and get it the first time in order to pass the exam. So they do have to pass the exam in order to, both exams in order to be certified.
Now, is that like college courses where you would maybe not go 8, or is that like 8 hours a day, basically?
It's college courses now. Of course, the courses aren't necessarily all-day courses, just like in any college. You take this particular class for radiation safety and health, and you might take another class in infection control, that kind of thing. So they have several different classes. And it's actually a coursework that's presented by, most cases, by the Dental Assisting National Board, and the community colleges here provide that instruction, and it qualifies for all the financial aid and everything. So it's a traditional course. The DANBE exam, the Dental Assisting National Board, is the that provides the examination, and they have to submit x-rays to verify that they can take them appropriately with their exam. They are the ones that are used nationally to certify that they know what they're doing, that they've, and in order to pass their exams. But every state we know uses that exam, and so we are very consistent here in Oregon in that regard, and it's not the intention of the Dentists of Oregon or the Oregon Dental Association to change that.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Could I respond to Senator Morissette's question? If you were to compare the radiation from 4 bite wing x-rays on a scale of 0 up or down, the 4 x-rays would take about 0.04 millisieverts. That's something that I'm sure you're not familiar with. But 0.04, an upper GI series would be 2.4, a lower GI series would be 4, so it's really a major amount of X radiation. And a full mouth series would be about 0.2. 0.04 for 4 bite wings, and a full mouth series 0.1. But GI series are like 4 and 2, so quite a difference in radiation. This came from the Texas Dental Journal.
Thank you.
Senator Fisher, if you were interested, if part of the question was about where are the dental assistants taught in Oregon, I have a list from Dr. Peterson, who served on the workforce, and she listed out there are 6 public schools of dental assisting in Oregon: Blue Mountain Community College, Central Oregon Community College, Mecca, Lane Community, Lynn Benton Community College, Portland Community College. In addition, there are 3 private schools: Concord, Northwest Dental Institute, and Apollo. So if that helps you understand how they're being trained generally in classes. And I think it needs to be said that looking at this problem, what this would do is allow the Board of Dentistry to set the standards for what is safety training. The Health Division's safety training, it has it listed in subjects. Maybe this would help you understand what they're talking about for safety training. This is not operating the machine. This is the nature of x-rays, interaction of x-rays with matter, radiation units, principles of the x-ray machine, biological effects of x-ray, principles of radiation protection, low-dose techniques, applicable radiation regulations, darkroom and film processing, and film critique. So those are aimed at making sure that the student who is trying to reach a certain safety standard, both for the patient, for themselves, understands the science, what the effect of radiation is and how it's being used here. And what we hear from some of the dental instructors is requirements that there be so many hours in these don't really make a lot of sense. What we need is some flexibility, so the Board of Dentistry could say we need more clinical hours of actual taking and exposing of film than we do of some of the sit-down classroom kind of book learning type hours. Certainly other states do not have this kind of regulation by hours. They pretty much say if you can pass the Dental Assistants National Board exam, we will certify you to take, and that requires exposing some films that they look at. And you got to understand, the dentist has absolutely no investment in having somebody work in the office who cannot expose a radiograph properly, because A, it's their diagnostic tool. It's what they're looking at to see what they need to do. It's what they're going to have to use to back up any claim or any discipline if somebody complains that something went wrong. And they're not invested in having an assistant who has to do retakes. Patients don't like that. So everybody's interested in the safety standard. What we're trying to do is create a more flexible environment so the board could say, we don't even need 30 hours. What we need is passage of an exam and a demonstration that you're competent and so many clinical hours. They're still going to get trained in schools mostly. Some of the rural areas, we're trying to develop a distant learning program for a big part of their examination. But they're still going to have to produce x-rays of quality so that they will be assessed on whether or not they can take a decent, adequate film for diagnostic purposes.
May I?
Yes, Senator Morrison.
On issues such as this, it's not uncommon to get mixed messages from dentists, from members of your community. So, and I see one email in opposition to the dentist. Now, I haven't received any, and I didn't, actually, I didn't talk to my dentist about it because I wasn't really aware that this bill was going to be here this week. He is the former president of the Dental Association, Stephen Theron in Springfield. Usually on top of everything that goes on, I haven't heard from him. What's the reading in your association? Is there a split? Does everybody unanimously agree except this one person that should be?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dental Association is solidly behind this. I understand you may have some differing opinions within the association about, let's let the health division do it. They've been doing it. Well, once upon a time, the Board of Dentistry took care of the whole thing. And, I mean, I guess you can have divisions like that. People have preferences. It went through, we've gone through about a decade of talking with the health division trying to get them to understand that we think their requirements are presenting an obstacle to dental assistants coming into the workforce in our state. I think the association is solidly behind that. And certainly the legislation was discussed. The Board of Dentistry was going to request it, or did request it. It just didn't get to you in that form. Certainly in the legislature, there is a lot of intent currently, and the governor's office has a lot of intent to reduce overlapping regulation and perhaps to, particularly where the workforce is involved, to try to get people employed, to make it a little simpler for them without, reducing in any way patient safety or safety standards for the people who operate the machinery. The health division's main function on dental x-ray, they're inspectors of x-ray equipment. And we feel like if they weren't involved in the case-by-case determination from a dental assistant's coursework, okay, they've been working in another state for a number of years and they've been certified and they're coming here, and the coursework they did still has to satisfy Oregon's. That's a case-by-case determination. The receptionist who handles this at the Board of Dentistry said to me, it takes some time to do that, and why that's necessary, it doesn't seem to be a real necessary function. They could use the time to inspect x-ray equipment, which a lot of the dentists feel the calibration and safety of the actual machinery is a more important function of the health division, and the Board of Dentistry certainly could be delegated to do the operator training part of it.
Thank you.
I think I finished this.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gail Shibley.
Thank you.
Okay. Chair, members of the committee. Once again, for the record, my name is Gail Shibley. I'm the administrator of the Office of Public Health Systems for the state of Oregon. I wish I could be testifying in favor, once again, in partnership with an important stakeholder in public health. We value the relationship that we have with all of our stakeholders, certainly with the dental community. Unfortunately, we find that we are in solid opposition to 3508. It does not make sense logically. It does not make sense practically. It does not make sense fiscally. It doesn't solve a problem or deal with an issue that we think is appropriate to be dealt with in this way. Since the late 1940s, we have been the single entity in the state of Oregon for assuring radiation safety, both for the people who operate the machines, operate around the machines, day in, day out, week after week, month after month, year after year, as well as the individual people, patients, general public. And that kind of safety requires both proper functioning machines and the skill to know how to use them. And 3508 would, we believe, artificially sever the connection of that comprehensive integrated oversight that we have had in one part of one area. We, from a public health perspective, we believe it's very critical to assure that operators of X-ray machines have adequate training, whether those machines are used in a medical setting by hospitals, by clinics, veterinarians, podiatrists, radiologists, dentists, chiropractors, anybody else, or in academic or in industrial facilities. We have indeed been working with our stakeholders, including those in the dental community, and have been hearing their concerns with the just shy of 3 months tenure that I have in my position. I know that we have processed through rules that were effective the end of March. I believe it was March 23rd that, in fact, reduced the number of radiation safety training hours that folks in Oregon need to satisfy in order to work with X-ray emitting radiation machines in dental setting. That's 30 hours. That is less than podiatrists, chiropractors, naturopaths, osteopaths, physicians, etc. It is less than anybody else in any kind of setting, with the exception of veterinarians. And in fact, radiation exposure from dental X-rays is a significant issue. I know that there was discussion just a moment ago, as there was on the House side in committee, about the amount of exposure per view based on different kinds of X-ray examinations. The information that that I have gotten from my folks in radiation protection services here in the state is that for an adult dental bite wing, the amount of exposure per view is anywhere from 300. Of course, it depends. I'm not going to cite very specific numbers here, but around average 330 millirems. You multiply that by the number of exposures, you get around 990 millirems. Compare that to a chest X-ray that is average of about 12 millirems. You take about two views, that's about 24 millirems. Or a skull X-ray. You generally take about two views, 70 millirem, another is about 145 millirem, for a total of 215 millirem for a skull X-ray versus typical three exposure bite wing of 990 millirem. When you have machines that are operated in a way that that they are improperly positioned, the tubes are improperly positioned, or that the beams themselves are inaccurately restricted, it can expose patients to unnecessary radiation in pretty critical areas of the head, including the eyes, the thyroid, and the brain. Frankly, the thyroid is a particularly critical area. We are frankly proud of the fact that dental assistants in Oregon historically score at the very highest levels in the Dental Assistant National Board test. We believe that that is good for the people who are operating those machines, as well as good for the overall public. And we think that it's something that that we ought to continue, build on, celebrate. And we are concerned that of anything that would threaten that national standing. We do know that the Oregon Board of Dentistry, with whom we work very, very closely, for a period of time, somewhere around a decade or more ago, was taking more and more of an active role. And again, we work in very close partnership with them. They, however, were rather overstepping their statutory bounds, and their assistant AG said, maybe you shouldn't be doing this. And sure enough, they stopped doing it. And that's perhaps some of the comments that you heard earlier about, well, it used to be the responsibility of the ODB. No, it didn't. It never was. But clearly we work very closely with them, as we do with all the healthcare licensing folks. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you have. Thank you very much.
Question? Senator Starr, excuse me.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Gail. Mr. Chair, I am concerned about the two different comparisons we have of exposure here. It seems to me that what you're saying is that there's a high-intensity exposure in a very limited area, while the exposure you're comparing it to is over a much larger area, which in fact would have a greater impact on the body than the intense exposure of one tooth or side of the mouth, perhaps. How in fact should we look at this exposure comparison?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I can tell you I'm not familiar with the numbers or the source that were provided earlier. Frankly, perhaps if we'd had an opportunity to sit down and discuss this, we could save the committee a whole bunch of time. But unfortunately, I can't speak to those numbers. What I can tell you is that the radiologists, the physicists, and the other scientists that I have reporting to me, who are the state authority on radiation, have provided me these numbers that show diagnostic medical and dental x-ray exposure comparisons. Again, every x-ray is somewhere within a range, an average range, and so there's always a little, there's some possibility, which is why I think in my testimony I say something like at least 13 times and up to 35 times. Some of my certified smart scientists said, well, I'd feel better if you just said, well, around 30. Well, I wanted to be as specific as I could based on their readings and their fact finding over a long period of time.
Further question?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Seems to me your other testimony regarding exposure to sensitive organs and so on that anyone who works with teeth or works with dentists know where the teeth are located. It would be a pretty simple matter to focus on those as opposed to thyroid glands or eyes or some other place. It doesn't appear to me that there's any likelihood that this is going to be a problem.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I'm not sure there's a question mark on the end of that, but I will tell you that these are very legitimate concerns that are being raised from folks who know more than you or I will ever know about the specific physical property of how ionizing radiation is transmitted through human flesh. I can't answer more than that.
Yes, Senator Brown.
Gail, I think one of the concerns I have about your position is that you know, we have a health care crisis in Oregon in terms of people having access to health care, and I would include dental care. And I guess what I hear from the Dental Association is that because of the requirements that DHS has in terms of the X-ray certification process, is that it's really limiting the number of folks that can do this work. And I guess I'd like you to respond to that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I'm happy to. And it's clearly a concern for any of us in Oregon, particularly those of us who work in the Department of Human Services. No one knows probably better than we do every single day just what some of the crises are. Some of the other pieces of my responsibility include, for example, licensing and certification of emergency medical technicians and services, ambulances, healthcare licensing, in-home care, healthcare agencies, and so on. And I'm very concerned about workforce development issues. In fact, I was at a meeting up at OSU last week talking about environmental health sanitarians, another area that we get to care about. There was a question raised specifically about what's called reciprocity, that is when out-of-state folks want to come to Oregon and work here. We average anywhere from about 3.5 to 6.5 requests each month, specifically for dental assistance. And that's somewhere around 40 to 80 a year. The processing time, average processing time investigated and found was that it's about a half an hour to three quarters of an hour of for lack of a better word, an investigator's time, as well as about a half an hour of administrative support time, depending on the completeness of the information of the out-of-state applicant. We verify. We don't take anything for granted when somebody shows up, you know, something arrives in the mail, a piece of paper. We check references. We talk to people. We talk to the folks that they used to work with and make sure that everything is as it needs to be. In terms of the folks coming through the programs, as I believe Ms. Myers pointed out, there are about a dozen or more, mostly public, a few private schools, training areas where folks can be certified. And we certify the curriculum. We verify the credentials of the instructors, make sure that they know what they're talking about, so, again, that people get the proper type of education. We have not heard anything from any of those instructors or from the facilities that they're somehow turning people away or otherwise running into any obstacles. Lastly, regarding distance learning, we're also particularly concerned about making sure that healthcare is available, especially in the rural areas of our state. And we are now in the final throes, thanks to folks in the dental community who said, hey, what do you think? Let's figure out a way that we can use distance learning to take care of some of the education pieces of what our folks need to learn. And we are now in the final stages of assessing a proposal from an out-of-state company that would provide for web-based learning. Again, making this kind of information, education, training available to people, rural, urban, suburban, Oregon, all over the state. We do not know that somehow this is a bottleneck in making sure that people can become dental assistants in Oregon.
Thank you. You know, it might astonish the committee, but you're looking at a dental assistant. You're looking at somebody that's been through the X-ray training and stuff years ago when the equipment and technical ability was probably a tenth of what it is now, if even that much. And it defies my imagination to think that when I go to my dentist and get a couple of bite wings, x-rays that I wind up getting way more x-rays than I did when they were shooting clear through my body to get my spine and everything else on a picture this big. X-ray film is x-ray film, and it takes about so much to develop it. And if you've got to go through 18 inches of body to get it done, it only stands to reason it's going to take a little more power than it did, because that's what we had to do. If we didn't get a clear enough x-ray, we had to increase the timing and so forth of the actual shot of radiation. So I just can't hardly buy that we're talking here that we're getting as much as 10, 12 times in a set of mouth x-rays what you're getting over something of a third of the body or something like that. But I know this much, that it was not that difficult to learn the proper methods, and it did not take that long to learn the proper methods to take x-rays. And we didn't have the fancy holders and things like that for our bite wings and stuff that they have now, which almost ensures an excellent x-ray out there. And it is technically necessary to know how to aim those machines, because if you aim them too steep, you wind up and get teeth about a foot long and slender, and you can't tell what it is. Or if you stub them down to where they're tooth about that long, if you get them the other way. So there are necessary things to do. As far as mistakes, I don't know that anybody, any human, is going to be able to 100% guarantee that they would never pull something like Senator Morissette said, where they got tooth number four, tooth number five. But I know that our training course in the military was an 8-week course. Now, we studied all day long from morning till 8 o'clock in the morning till without a noon hour break, and then till 5 o'clock. And we didn't spend anyways near 1/8 of that time, or 40 hours, which would be a full solid week study on the x-ray portion of that. And quite frankly, after working for a couple years or more in the dental corps of the military, we were not having problems with eyesight and the thyroid problems and things like that with these young guys that we were x-raying, and they were going through the x-rays with regularity, because considering the place that we were dealing with, we had people with extremely poor teeth, and they got a lot of x-rays. And my feeling is that we've got a situation here where people have tried to work out something and have not been successful in working with the government agency. And, you know, I'd like to say that we could work these things out, but it is pretty apparent that it hasn't worked that way.
Well,
and from my own experience in this particular field, I would like to relieve them of the extra work and things that I don't think really speaks to the x-ray process as much as what it does, plus the fact that they're being charged more for the x-ray portion, which is only a minor portion. They're actually be charged for a clinical test.
I guess I learned from my mayor days, and Representative Anderson, who was a mayor, also learned that the reason you have a public hearing is that you listen to the testimony and you make your decision based on what people are telling you. Now, I did talk with, we went to our chairs meeting, the leadership, and we talked about which bills we were going to hear. I didn't raise an objection at that time because I wasn't paying that much attention, I guess, to some of the things that came up since then. I did have an experience at a dentist Friday where they had to take two shots. I did read the information about the intensity. Before I can vote for this, which I could if I have some clarifying information about what is the strength of that x-ray in your mouth. Now, we've heard contradictory testimony. One is that the very focused beam is 30 times, well, from 13 to 35 times more significant than the chest x-ray. We've heard conflicting testimony that it is much less. To me, that's an important point. And I think I'm not sure that I want to change the existing safeguards in using that, unless I have that answer. So I don't know what the vote is going to be, but I would like to have that before I vote on it. I can't support it until I know that, because it is a very significant fact, and it is focused on a very small part of your head, and I'd like to know the answer.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Could we hear from the three House members that are here on another bill? I'm just concerned if we don't hear from them soon, there'll be more House members coming over. And we'll have the whole House over here.
Is that a bad thing? I mean,
well, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing.
I need to think about it.
Rather than force a vote here in honor of Senator Morissette's desires, I would like to find out that answer myself. Representative Anderson, would you be able to
get verification?
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, I would appreciate if we could do that, and more than likely we'll have another meeting here, and at which time we can discuss this further. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3508 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3609, and we're going to get a bunch of representatives up here shortly. Come on up while the staff introduces the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3609 directs the Department of Human Services to establish three pilot programs to assist veterans and their spouses or their dependents in applying for veterans benefits. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and we do have a -3 amendment that I believe Representative Gallegos would like to talk to you about.
All right, go right ahead and whichever order you wish to.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Farr, representative from District 14, which is Junction City, Santa Clara, and a portion of Eugene. I wish Senator Morissette were still here, because I would remind him that the last time I asked him for help, I was a city councilor in Eugene, and he was the mayor of Springfield. And I asked him to help me get funding for Station 7, which is a shelter for homeless kids, and he came through at the time. And I wish he were here for me to ask him to come through again for us. Also, it's difficult for me coming up here after expert testimony such as you've been hearing regarding the previous bill, but perhaps you can gauge my salary by the length of my testimony. Mr. Chair, I'm speaking for the 33,831 veterans in Lane County and for the 367,000 veterans living in Oregon. House Bill 3609 provides for a pilot program in Lane County, Clackamas, and Washington counties to provide outreach to our veterans to assist them in accessing service programs that they've earned and that they deserve. What's happening now is that many veterans aren't aware of a lot of the programs that are available throughout the state in the various facilities that we have in Oregon, and this funds positions to help veterans, spouses, and dependents to who were talking about you while you were gone, Senator Morissette.
Oh.
Help veterans, their dependents, and their spouses to access services that they simply don't know about. The outreach will screen them for eligibility and give them needed help in submitting their applications. It sounds like a program that's going to cost a lot of money, but really ultimately this will actually be saving the state money. That's been demonstrated in programs that are currently existing. We're asking for it in three counties, in Lane County, Clackamas, and Washington counties, as
Multnomah,
Clackamas, I don't know the difference.
But
Mr.
Lane,
Chair, Lane. Representative Carr, yes, it makes a difference.
there are certain things that would help your bill to pass here, but you don't want to admit.
The great county of Multnomah is an integral part of this program. And so it sounds like it's going to cost money, but really, ultimately, will save the state money by accessing federal funds and saving the state money from the Oregon Health Plan, et cetera. It's a pilot program for three counties, the names of which completely elude me at the time. But the reason we're doing it with three counties is that there is a heavy concentration of veterans in these three counties. The services are available in the three counties, and by demonstrating that it's going to be a worthwhile program, we ultimately can spread it to other counties in the state. And with that, I'll turn the mic over. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, I might ask you to move right along if you possibly can here. We probably took a little longer than we should have on the previous bill, but I think it was more controversial than this is.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mary Gallegos, State Representative from House District 29, which is Forest Grove, Cornelius, and Hillsborough areas in Washington County. And as the good representative from Lane County mentioned, it's a pilot program to assist veterans who are currently receiving state Medicaid benefits. And it directs the Department of Human Resources and or Human Services, I think it is now, and the Dash 1-2 amendments, the amendments that you have in front of you, we're asking that the it be given in a grant to the existing county veteran service officers who are already there, already in the field, already certified, trained, and ready to go and do this in those counties to help those who are currently receiving state services, help them get into the veterans programs that are available. We've picked these three counties because of the concentration of veterans that are there and the accessibility to services, which was quite critical, especially as we drafted this. Legislative Council insisted it could only be for these three counties because, since of the scope of it, we were looking to help the veterans, their spouses, and dependents. These were the three counties that actually have access to all those services. In the future, with savings, we believe that this could be propagated to other counties, and that would be the hope, but it would need to be modified for each of those counties based on the services that are available, because we don't want to take someone off of a Medicaid program and not have services available to fill that need.
Absolutely.
So,
Mr. Chair?
Senator Brown.
Representative Gallegos, two questions. My recollection is that the one county where the pilot program is functioning is Washington County. Is that correct?
Washington and Multnomah have been tracking the data. They were, it was a budget note last session. DHS stopped funding it, but those two counties have continued to track the data as they were able to move some of those veterans off of the state portals and onto the veterans programs. The other good plus is here, once they start getting them on the veterans programs, their services from the veterans become retroactive. So the veteran himself can be reimbursed, and in some cases we believe the state can be reimbursed for some services that they have received, and the state receives
savings. Is there any opposition to the bill? I know that the DHS has some concerns about it, but is there any opposition to the bill?
I believe that there is disagreement from ODVA,
okay,
who is here.
All right.
But other than that, I have not had anybody. And there is disagreement in that fiscal that I'm sure you have, mm-hmm, showing that DHS requires 8.5 full FTEs, where there are currently only 4.5 existing ODVA officers in Washington, Multnomah, and Lane counties. So therefore, they would need to be supervised by, apparently there's a need to have four people supervising 4.5 people. We would disagree with that, but hope that that could be worked out in ways and means to resolve some of the funding, try to mitigate where the savings are coming from, when they'll be coming, and what the actual costs are.
Oh, thank you, Senator Fisher. I'm Representative Patty Smith. I represent Multnomah County, Clackamas and Hood River, but I said Multnomah first. Got to keep on track here. I'm supporting this. Who could not support our veterans? I mean, these people have put their life on the lines, and many times their lives, and their families have made the supreme sacrifices. So whatever we can do, we need to do for our veterans. And with the short supply of resources that have been available, these pilot programs are a way to help our veterans access benefits, and I think it creates cost savings for us. So I'm just here to offer my support and ask for your support.
Okay, thank you very much. Call John Mangus and James Tate.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Tate from the Department of Human Services Senior and Disability Programs. Very briefly, since this was not included in the governor's budget, we have reworked with Washington and Multnomah counties, and they've consulted with Lane County, and there is a revised fiscal that's about a half or a third of what the original fiscal is. So I think everyone is in agreement on what the dollar amount up front would be needed to fund the staff in the three pilot areas, so that there is no disagreement on that. The dilemma we had in the pilot during the current biennium, which we will need to resolve in the Ways and Means Committee if this goes forward, is how to net out savings or cost avoidance in the Medicaid program, convert it to cash, and move it over to pay the costs of this particular program. And the dilemma for us is we operate the Medicaid program on a statewide basis, so if you don't take a dollar out of Medicaid at the county level and move it over to fund the veteran staff. And so that's kind of the struggle we've had, is because there's no argument that if you get someone signed up for veterans benefits and you can take them off Medicaid or avoid having them go on to Medicaid in the first place, that that's a net savings. So that's not an argument with us. We simply need to figure out what formula you would use to net out savings in a statewide budget to replenish the staff costs at a local county level. And I think that's something that we're proposing to work with the counties and LFO staff once it gets to Ways and Means.
Okay. John?
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, John Mangus, Department of Veterans Affairs, and for everybody that's known me for the last 33 years, if I can get anything for veterans, I'll take it. So, you know, this program does target veterans, and it provides some assistance for veterans, and therefore that's good. But if I'm speaking for, I suppose, 33,000 veterans in Lane County, I'm speaking for 365,000 veterans in the state of Oregon, it does bother me that it's a limitation for three counties. My feeling ever since I started was, you know, a vet living in Lake Bluesview was just as important as a veteran living in downtown Portland. As was mentioned, it was brought to my attention, there is no money in the governor's budget, but apparently that's going to be worked out. And one of the comments by one of the representatives who was here, that there was a possibility for retro payments on medical service provider, that the payments are established, that would be the ultimate and rarity where the VA would go back and reimburse for medical care after the award had been made. It's usually from the date forward. They can be retroactive to the date of application, but there's a real question on whether you'll see any benefit to that portion of it. And the other thing that I would just mention is ORS 408-410, which is already on the books, basically says exactly the same thing as House Bill 3609 does, except for Section 1, Sub 4, that if a county appoints, or a county may appoint a county veteran service officer, and if they do, they shall furnish an office and fund that office to assist a veteran, their dependents, and survivors in applying for any federal, state, or local benefit. That's already there. So that's the expression of my concerns. Other than that, DHS can work that out, and that's fine, too.
Senator Brown.
Thanks. So as I understand it, your first concern is that if we're going to do this, you think it should be statewide. Is that correct?
Senator Fisher, Senator Brown, I feel that any program for veterans ought to encompass all the veterans of the state. If it's a benefit here in the Valley, then, you know, a veteran living in the Bend or wherever else should be entitled to the same. The greatest benefit, if you think you're going to be moving people off of public assistance onto federal benefits, that come in the more populous counties, Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, Lane. But, you know, I think if more dollars are going to become available to help veterans, you know, just veterans in general, then it should be statewide. And I don't know whether we are targeting only veterans that are receiving public assistance for 3609, or are we making this available to all veterans in Washington, Multnomah, and Lane?
That's okay. Mr. Chair?
Senator Brown.
One other question. I guess, and then the second part of your testimony, what I heard you say is that essentially this bill is not necessary, that's already in statute. And I guess my sort of pushback with you is, well, if it's necessary, why is it not happening now? And, you know.
Senator Fisher, Senator Brown. I'm not saying that it's not necessary to get more funds out in the field to help veterans. My money that I get in my budget that I distribute to counties allows me to, based on the dollars I get, 75% of their budget up to $12,500. That top figure has not changed since 1981. So since if you look at 1989 dollars, that's 2% less than I got in 1989, while the rest of the general fund of the state of Oregon, I think, has increased 139% in real dollars. So the dollars for veterans has not kept up since 1989. The dollars that I have in my budget today would allow me to reimburse just under $10,000 to the counties, so it's dropped from the 12.5 down to somewhere in the neighborhood of $9,400-$9,500. So when you say a program like this and helping veterans, I'm all for it because it gives money. But the issue is it doesn't help everybody because everybody's taken a cut in their county budgets. For veterans, and counties just don't have the money to fund it at the level they should either.
Senator Morsette.
Thank you. It's interesting because this bill also covers the veterans' spouses and dependents of veterans.
Senator Fisher, Senator Morsette, yes, as does 408-410.
Pardon me?
As does the other. All Oregon law is to assist all veterans, survivors, okay. And dependents.
In approximately 7 minutes, we're going to be meeting somewhere to talk about the Oregon Health Plan and how we save the Oregon Health Plan. Now, it seems to me that this would be one thing that we should really look at. And why couldn't we go statewide? I mean, are there compelling reasons in terms of your department in figuring out statewide, rather than counties? Would this be a significant savings? Is there a significant fiscal impact?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morsette, the problem that we've had is we cannot figure out a formula for taking a statewide Medicaid program down to a micro level in a county. And the reason for that is that the statewide Medicaid budget, both in health care and in long-term care, goes up and down for many, many different reasons that are quite independent of whether we reach a series of folks and get them on veterans benefits in replacement of Medicaid. For example, last biennium, the department, in rebalancing in front of the e-board on multiple occasions, had to adjust upward the Medicaid caseload, notwithstanding that in the pilot areas they were claiming major savings in having diverted persons to veterans, but we were still increasing the Medicaid budget because the caseload was going up for other reasons. So that's the problem, has been how to make the direct link from a dollar theoretically saved here converted into cash to pay for the VA person over here, and I think that's what we've said. We need help with that because we can't figure out how to do that, and that's, I think, for Ways and Means and LFO to figure out a formula, and if we can, that's great, but we need the upfront amount to pay the county or the area agencies on aging to reimburse the veterans officers.
I'm going to go ahead and close the hearing on this today because it looks like there's some more work to be done, some questions to be answered. We've got one more bill that we need to get out today. Yeah, we will be having another meeting down the line probably in about 2 weeks. And I think we can get some further additional information, and the questions have been alerted here. And I apologize to the three gentlemen that are here, Jeff and Frank and Greg. We definitely will have your testimony and have you folks on when we continue this bill at a later date. So I'm going to close the public hearing. I thank folks for coming here and testifying, and maybe spend a little more time maybe on your problem, Jim and James, in the next week or so, and see if we can't come up with something. And probably some of that could also be decided down in the Ways and Means itself. Thank you. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3609. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2631. Representative Jensen, come up while staff.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2631 permits clinical labs to report lab results to patients in addition to an authorizing physician. We have the dash A5 amendment from Representative Jensen, and he's here to explain that to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you very much for hearing House Bill 2631, which comes to you via a couple of constituents of mine at their request, and I have had the bill drafted for them. And I recognize you're running short on the calendar, so let me try to be very brief. I think at this particular point, that there is no opposition to this bill. We did have, when we were working, when the bill was being worked on the House side, some concerns about the bill and from the OMA, and we have tried very hard to address the concerns of the OMA, and you'll see those addressed in the Dash 5 amendment. And I must thank my good friend and colleague from Ashland, representative from Ashland, Dr. Bates, who provided the language for this and, in fact, did offer a floor speech in favor of the bill on the House side when with the assumption that these amendments were going to be brought forward. The idea and the concern was that that the doctor have an opportunity to respond prior to the time that the patient might get the test results, and that's the reason for the 7 days that you'll see in there, to make sure that the doctors had an opportunity to contact and call the patient. And this is especially true and especially important in those cases where any diagnosis might be life-threatening and might be seen to have the potential to cause a patient to do something irresponsible, if you wish. So the doctor would have a chance, and certainly would, within a 7-day period of time, if it was a life-threatening thing, be contacting the patient and bringing you know, them in for further consultation. One of the reasons, and it wasn't discussed much in the when we talked about it in the House side, if you I did hand out two very personal letters from Blue Mountain Diagnostics to you, and one of them, the earlier one, you will note, and both have to do with mammogram reports, and the patient in question was Evelyn Jensen, who happens to be my wife, and I believe, Mr. Chairman, I don't think I've identified myself. I'm State Representative Bob Jensen from District 58 in Pendleton-Hermiston areas. In the first one of those reports, you will see that the first report was a positive, at least as far as some issues of concern for breast cancer, and the doctor immediately contacted Evelyn and made arrangements for her to go back in for the second report, and of course we were much relieved when we got the second report, because it comes up negative as far as breast cancer was concerned. And it is not, however, the nature of what those were, but imagine had these two letters but kind of been reversed, and I'm referring to the kind of upper right hand report where it says the report is sent to. You will notice on the one where it says that it's positive, the one that's dated May 14, report is sent to John, excuse me, John Gardner. John Gardner is an MD and is our primary care physician. You'll note on the second one, the report is sent to Helen Kilzer, MD, and it's important to note that Helen Kilzer is not our physician. And had the first report gone to and had it, as this potentially is life-threatening, had the first report gone to Helen Kilzer, there's no assurance that it would have ever gotten back to Evelyn Jensen and to enable her to go in and check to see whether it really was cancer or whether it was some other image that they were seeing. That's no reflection on Dr. Kilzer. It's merely that Dr. Kilzer doesn't have a patient named Evelyn Jensen, and would not necessarily know where and how to get a hold of her. Probably they would send it back to the lab, or maybe somebody in the office would just get a hold of the report, and it's not our patient, and ignore it. Whatever. In talking to Dr. Bates, one of the things he noted was that the patient is the next best source to follow up on laboratory information. And he was very positive about having patients know. Of course, also with the mammogram report, Mr. Chair, already know that mammogram, by federal statute, all mammogram reports have to be sent directly to the patient, sort of thing. And given your time schedule, Mr. Chair, I know you're under time constraints, I'll stop there, but I'll be delighted to try and answer any questions you might have.
So you're proposing the -3 or -5 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would not be comfortable if the -5 amendments were not added to the bill.
Okay, thank you very much. Catherine Otto, Elizabeth Smith, and Tim Martinez. Could I encourage you to make your remarks as quickly as possible? I apologize for that.
Not a problem.
Several of us do in another committee here in about 2 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Catherine Otto. I am a member of the Oregon Association for Clinical Laboratory Science and one of those practitioners that provides the laboratory services for Oregonians. In concept, when the bill was presented on the House side, we support the bill. We believe this increases access for patients to their own laboratory information. We also believe that it will streamline the process if the laboratory directly sends the results to the patient at the patient's request upon the time the testing is performed. I have to tell you, we saw the amendment when we arrived this afternoon, and frankly, we're concerned that this is now making double work for the laboratory if we have to wait for 7 days after we receive the request. If the bill, as it's written without the amendment, says that a patient can have access to their own laboratory results, we will give them their laboratory results, provided the law says we can. If we do this, we have to wait for that request, and inevitably, probably, it will become our onus then that we have to phone the physician to ask for that. So you're asking for more work in this case, and you're negating a sense of the law of the access piece. Now, certainly the life-threatening pieces, the physician should be phoning the patient, should be phoning the laboratory to find out when the results are done. If something is critical, we phone the physician right away if it's life-threatening laboratory results. And one last comment regarding something Representative Jensen mentioned. This law only addresses clinical laboratory testing, not mammograms. That is in radiology. We perform all the diagnoses which are bodily fluids or tissues then. With that, I would like to end my... Heidi has some other here. Excuse me. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Fisher. My name is Elizabeth Smith. I represent the Oregon Association for Clinical Laboratory Science. We do have some major concerns with this bill, with the amendment, excuse me, the -5 amendment. I think the way the original bill was proposed, the major impact will be that a patient can call the laboratory and say, gee, I had my cholesterol done this morning, can you tell me what the result was? Or I'm leaving town this evening and I need to know what my pro time is. We're not talking about written results. We're not talking about tests such as HIVs or things like this that are very complicated, and that the laboratory, in fact, does not want to give directly to the patient. But for the procedure such as a cholesterol or Maybe some woman's on iron and she needs to know if her hemoglobin has come up and it's over 13 or whatever. That's what this bill is addressing, and that's what we're talking about. And for us to say, well, I'm sorry, we have to wait until 7 days after those results become available, you have efficiently negated the entire intent of the bill, and we're right back where we started from. And quite frankly, the laboratory is not going to want to be involved with counting out 7 days and saying, well, we have to wait. You know, these results just became available 2 days ago, so you've got to wait 5 more days before we can tell you what your cholesterol is. We're not going to do it.
It says 7 days from the request of a patient, not 7 days from the result or from the test.
Well, it'll be 7 days.
Well, and that brings up another point. There are several procedures that are done in the laboratory that take longer than 7 days. One example would be certain cultures, types of cultures. So a patient can request all they want, but if the results are not available, we're still not going to be able to give it to them.
It says not sooner than 7 days, so it doesn't limit you to going longer.
Right, but my point is that, I mean, if you come in this morning and have your cholesterol done, that result is going to be available by 4 o'clock this afternoon. So we now have to wait. You call up this evening at 7 o'clock and say, I want to know what my cholesterol is, and I am the person who answers the phone. I'm going to have to go in and find out when is it available, and then I'm going to have to tick off 7 days from this afternoon at 7 o'clock and tell this poor patient, no, I can't give it to you. You have to wait 7 days.
Chair, could I ask Representative Jensen to come up and tell us if he really, really, really wants this amendment, or can we just pass this bill out as it is and be done with it?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, again, for the record, State Representative Bob Jensen, House District 58. Do I really, really want the amendment? I have made a commitment to Dr. Bates that for the amendment. Okay. I'm really sorry that I haven't had a chance to talk to the folks here. I think they're misconstruing how onerous this might be. I don't believe that this is something that's going to be a major problem for them. Then the reason for the amendment was that there is laboratory information that the patient is entitled to. They are entitled to. That is life-threatening. And the medical profession, I believe Mr. Martinez would speak to that, the medical profession feels strongly, I think they may be a little bit overreacting, but that's neither here nor there. They feel strongly that they want to be able to call the patient before the patient sees in black and white that you're going to be dead in 30 days. I'm overstating the case. My apologies, Mr. Chair, but if it's life-threatening. So, yes, I have made a commitment to Dr. Bates for his support on the House floor for the amendment, and I would have to honor that commitment.
Tim, you want to...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association. I would just have to, echo what Representative Jensen has said. That was our equipment coming out of the House, was that we would make these amendments in the Senate. We are concerned with the bill as you have before you. At a minimum, we would like to have these amendments adopted.
I don't have a problem.
No, I don't either. Okay, thank you very much. That's the end of those that are wishing to testify. I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2631.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the -5 amendments to House Bill 2631.
Senator Starr moves the -A5 amendments to House Bill 2631. Is there any discussion? Objection? Will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Arnold?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morsett?
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. Senator Brown, Senator Burdick are excused. Senator Starr?
Motion carried.
Motion carries, I'm sorry.
I move House Bill 2631 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves House Bill 2631 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator
Carnell? Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator
Morissette?
Aye.
And Chair Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries. We have a carrier. Senator Starr will carry the bill. And again, Senator Brown and Senator Burdick are excused. I close and adjourn the Committee on Health and Human Services.
See you next week.